Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. When you talk about regional cuisine, things like Cajun food in New Orleans or seafood in Boston or Southern barbecue come to mind. But when it comes to Wisconsin, a feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine makes the point that the food itself is only part of the picture.
Ann Christensen is senior editor and dining critic at the magazine and the person behind the thought-provoking feature called Eat Like a Wisconsinite. Hey, Ann, nice to see you again. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So you and others in the article that kind of kicks this off make the point that Wisconsin cuisine is about more than just the flavors or even the foods themselves. So what is it about this subject that makes it right to talk about eating like a Wisconsinite rather than just eating Wisconsin foods?
Whoa, that sounds like almost a philosophical question.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is.
At first when we talked about doing this story, I felt daunted by it because, you know, first of all, people wonder, well, what is Wisconsin cuisine? There's that debate. It doesn't maybe have as much of a strong definition as like Southern food or, but I guess it was a way of getting at what is Wisconsin cuisine. But it is, it's so part of our own personal history and our forefathers and what they brought here and the economy and what grows here. It so transcends, yeah, just going, I guess, just the food itself.
Right. It's not the same as talking about Cajun cuisine.
Yeah.
Or...
But see, that to me is what intimidated me about like trying to take this on because I thought, well, my gosh, there's just so many elements here. How do we even do that?
Right. How would you define it? And I don't want to get too much into this because, you know, we've had umpteen interviews about supper clubs in the past, but supper clubs aren't in and of themselves a food, and some of them serve different foods, but they're an environment as much as anything.
And you know what? Somebody was asking me about supper clubs recently and like how and why they've sort of stuck around, and they've certainly had – they're certainly very big right now and kind of went through a period where they weren't. And I think part of it is people love nostalgia. You know, obviously the Mad Men TV show helped a lot. People, you know, really got into that. And what is that whole mystique of it? But there's just something, and maybe there's something about us as Wisconsinites that we really we have a lot of reverence for the past, too. And that way of dining is so comforting, and it's kind of slows you down. And
I was thinking about, you know, food as memory, and that's true in a lot of ways. But I think there are probably some people out there, lots of people out there, who might enjoy the supper club experience who neither have a personal connection to supper clubs nor do their families. I mean, when I go to a supper club, and I don't all that often, but I certainly enjoy the experience, but it was not part of my family tradition. So this is like food as someone else's memory.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's very interesting. And so then I guess you're creating your own memory or your own definition of what that means to you. What do you like about it, though? I mean, is it the food itself? Is it that, you know, you're in a place that it doesn't look like any other restaurant you're in? It really never does.
For me, it almost feels like, in my case, like it's eating in another culture, the same way that you know, you go to a Chinese restaurant and it feels a certain way. It's got the red lamps with the tassels hanging down off the ceiling, or you go out for, you know, what we think of as kind of old school Italian food. Maybe you've got the checkered tablecloths. A supper club feels a certain way that doesn't feel like any place else.
That is truly the beauty of it. And what I mean, maybe Ron Fiola has actually been on this show before, but he is kind of the supper club expert. So I went to him and I said, "Hey, Ron, give me a certain number, you know, 500 words on supper clubs. What is it that makes it so part of the fabric of being in Wisconsin and dining in Wisconsin? And then give us five of your favorites." So that's how we kind of handled it. And that's the way I would have done it myself as well. But we have photos taken of the Hobnob, which if you have not been there.
I have not been there.
It is, it's like being on the set of, I don't know, like Goodfellas or something like that. It's just walking back into, I don't know, some
Sinatra
point in time.
Laden, yes.
It's a Scorsese film that's like, it's so incredibly, strangely, beautifully kitschy.
The other thing I'll say about supper clubs, my colleague Bonnie North and I were having a conversation about restaurants, honestly, just a couple hours before you came in. And you know, we were talking about the volume level at restaurants, the decibel level. Yeah, the decibel level, the people needing to shout to be heard over the music. And I associate supper clubs with a certain low-level hubbub that there might be music playing, but you have to strain to hear it rather than strain to hear your dinner date.
And I'm not hearing impaired. I probably will be at some point in my life from all the restaurants I go to. But I have to say I don't like the trend of all the hard surfaces in restaurants and not a lot of and just loud music and loud everything so that you can't hear the person talk. Because that's part of the whole experience of dining. It's not just eating. It's having this experience with someone, right? I mean,
exactly.
Hopefully you're having that nice,
meaningful
dining experience, and it shouldn't be marred by the sound. But that's a great observation because, supper clubs will definitely kind of bring you into that.
And you mentioned hard surfaces, and supper clubs are the sort of the epitome of a soft surface restaurant.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're going to be sitting with that's a white tablecloth restaurant for sure. You're going to be doing that.
And banquettes,
the naugahyde chairs, the carpet, the patterned carpet. Right. You know, a lot of clothy surfaces, I would say.
So there are a handful of phenomena that you write about in this article that I'm maybe either not quite familiar with or they're a little under the radar, you know, less so than, say, supper clubs or old fashions or our dairy tradition. For starters, I am completely not familiar with a cannibal sandwich.
Well, you are you're not a native, correct?
No, I'm not.
You're not a Wisconsin native.
Right.
Well, you know.
Nor am I a cannibal.
I tell you. No, you're not a cannibal. Well, okay. But this is a thing that, you know, and maybe it comes from, there is, it definitely has German immigrants definitely brought this here. It's a sandwich that I was so used to seeing this as a kid, like every kind of like a home and school event at my grade school, if there was a buffet table, I'm telling you, these cannibal sandwiches were on the buffet table. No kid would ever take one. It was a parent. But my own parents were bridge. They played bridge. They had dinner parties. They would serve this. So to define what it is, okay, it's raw ground beef. It's raw ground beef that sometimes would be mixed with raw egg. Sometimes that would happen, but it would be always layered on maybe some buttered rye bread or marble rye bread. And then you put a little bit of raw onion on top for a little bit of sharpness and some salt and pepper. And that's it.
Why would you eat that?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. People love it, though. I mean, my father, if he were alive, would tell you this was probably one of his favorite things that he would look for during the holidays, and particularly during the winter holidays, is very, very big. And what
this is like a Polish or German sushi, or
it's a German. Yeah, it is. It's like a German sushi. That's a very good comparison. Well, what I was curious about is how big it still is, because it certainly was big in my parents' generation and their parents' generations. But if you go to butcher shops, I was calling butcher shops like Bunzel's, which is out on Burleigh. And I said, you know, do you guys still get requests for this? Oh, my gosh, yes. And we always have it available. Plus, they make their own rye bread, so you can get all the ingredients there, but particularly during, again, the winter holidays. But not just that, because I was asking people Packers games, Mitch. Packers games.
People are tailgating with the cannibal sandwich.
And then but then they have a ritual, because you got to be really careful with eating ground beef.
Well, right. Yeah.
So I've heard people have told me stories about how they would actually have the ground beef. They'd assemble it at the very last moment, but they have the ground beef in a bowl on top of another bowl of ice to keep that ground beef as cold as possible so that you weren't having it sitting out at room temperature on a buffet table with the possibility of some kind of, you know,
contamination.
Exactly.
Or whatever, right?
Because that is a risk there. But, you know, the intention is that you get this ground beef and you consume it quickly.
I think you would have to consume it quickly.
almost
without noticing.
Right.
also, a concept called Booyah, which I only know as an exclamation. Yeah. I have not heard of it as a food. What the heck is it?
Well, and I will tell you, some Minnesotans will claim that they're the Booyah capital. Booyah. So eating Wisconsin is not just eating Milwaukee.
Right,
okay.
Right.
So upper Wisconsin, especially the Green Bay and Door County areas, probably more Green Bay for this. Booyah is huge. And that is another thing. I ended up finding these people that go to events or make it. And it is not something that you don't just make like a two pound batch of Booyah. It doesn't work that way. You have some giant kettle that might be you. It's outside over, you know, wood or something. And you're making this for like 50 people.
This is a stew.
It's a gathering. But it's so tied into the communal experience of eating it with people. So it's a stew. It's a stew that has chicken and sometimes it has another kind of meat in it. And then it has like 10 kinds of vegetables. I mean, like essentially everything that's in a Wisconsin garden. You put the carrots in there and the lima beans and celery and everything. And it all goes in this giant kettle. And
this is like the Stone Soup story.
Yeah. And it's served oftentimes. Especially like in the Green Bay area, you'll go to maybe like an American Legion post. Mm-hmm. They have some big gathering or a church event, or it could be even at a giant like flea market, and they're cooking this thing out there. And you've got, again, like 50 or 100 people. But what's really interesting is I found this guy in Green Bay who calls himself Booyah Bob. And Booyah Bob learned how to make it from someone else who we called the King of Booyah. But it's a really, I mean, like not everybody knows how to do it. And you have to be entrusted with this recipe that you're not going to just share it with everyone. You're in the sense that you're going to just be like, oh, here's this recipe. You can have it. No, you're going to be the person that makes it and you're going to hold on to it. And then you're going to find that next person of the next generation to carry it on.
Would you? Well,
isn't
someone,
that an incredible story, right?
Yeah,
there?
And for someone who's never had it, would you? I mean, it's the kind of thing you could drive around Green Bay and look for the signs with the slide in letters, and maybe it'll say Booyah Supper or something.
Maybe this gentleman told me that he was seeing it for sale in quart containers at farmers market over the summertime. So I mean, you could, yeah, you might be able to see it. And just to go back to that word, Booyah, what? The story, one of the stories is, I mean, there's probably maybe no definitive answer, is that is kind of a morphing of the word bouillon, which is, you know, the French word bouillon for broth. And someone just couldn't say that and it became Booyah and that's how it was spelled. You know, who knows?
But this is obviously a decades long tradition.
Yeah. Yes.
Frozen custard gets a lot of press in this state. Mm-hmm. It is, of course, a close cousin to ice cream. I had not realized that there was a Wisconsin mystery linked to one famous flavor, Blue Moon ice cream.
I learned about this, too, in doing the story. I mean, I'd certainly seen it, especially going up north in the summertime to ice cream shops, ice cream parlors, and they always had that flavor. And I have to say, it wouldn't be the flavor I would choose, but every kid.
I was just going to say, if you're 10 or younger,
oh, yes.
This is the flavor you want.
They love it. And the funny thing was, it's like sort of, well, what does it taste like? You ask a kid, okay, what does it taste like? Well, maybe it tastes like Fruit Loops, or it tastes like Fruity Pebbles, or it tastes like sort of like some fruit. You're not really sure what it is. But I think kids gravitate to that sort of that blue color that is like.
It's why the blue raspberry Slurpees and
yes.
Slush Puppies do so well.
Right. And of course, it stains your lips, it stains your tongue. You know, everything about it is just a mess. It'll leak all over your car. But the interesting thing about this flavor is, you know, people wonder, well, where did it come from? Well, you know, there's a theory that there is a Milwaukee origination to it, a chemist who could be, maybe was the person to the first person to create that flavor.
The
maybe
evil
not.
Dr. Blue Moon.
Exactly. But he created this flavor, and it's kind of scary to think there are chemists that create flavors for us, but there are. And he certainly was helped spread that flavor. And if you look around, it's still, you can still get it. You can absolutely get it. And yeah, I don't know about your kid, but any of your kids,
my kids are aging through the Blue Moon phase.
I think that's part of the whole mystique of Blue Moon. You age through it. Right. It's a very interesting. That's a very interesting Wisconsin food.
Some Wisconsinites age their cheddar; others just age through Blue Moon ice cream.
Yeah,
you know. So these are all you write about these kind of Wisconsinite dining and eating traditions. If you're writing this story 20 years from now, would it look like this?
I hope some of it. I hope some of it would come back into that story. That would be part of it. I think Wisconsin, I hope Wisconsin's always going to be the dairy state and be a leader in cheese production and dairy production. And so things like frozen custard, milk, all of the cheeses, you know, that would all be part of it. I hope the supper club thing keeps going because to me that is, you know, it's such a beautiful tradition that has a very interesting history that you can read about here. But I do think some of... you know, I talk somewhat about our German traditions, but I think, you know, Mexican, the Hispanic traditions that are coming here from immigrants from Latin America and Asian, a lot of Asian immigrants that are coming here. I think those are going to be definitely part of the package. And, you know, a lot of foods that, you know, if you talk to chefs that really want to embrace Wisconsin cuisine, they'll say, well, I want to get my ingredients as close to my restaurant as possible so that they're getting foods that are grown here. Well, a lot of Asian farmers are growing foods here too. So, I mean, these are all becoming part of our culture. So, I think that would be I'm excited about the idea of maybe revisiting this.
It'll be interesting to see if any of these traditions, Mexican or Asian, can put their own stamp on the cannibal sandwich.
Yeah, right.
And great conversation. Thanks so much.
Anne Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine. You'll find a link to her feature on eating like a Wisconsinite, and you can have your say at WUWM.com.